Today is Wednesday, May 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Alexandria, Virginia. Fighting between Israel and Palestinians intensifies, with militant rockets penetrating Jerusalem's missile defense shield, resulting in the loss of life. Plus, volunteers are quietly collecting the ashes of India's unclaimed dead from the crematoriums to give the bodies respectful send-offs as per Hindu traditions. We'll have these stories and more next. That's the sound of explosions in a video from ADMAA that captured images of Palestinian rockets fired from Gaza exploding into an Israeli high-rise building in the southern city of Ashkelon on Tuesday. This as Israel and Hamas exchanged fire for a second day, ignited by unrest in Jerusalem. Israel also launched more airstrikes on Gaza Tuesday, hitting the high-rise home of a Hamas field commander. Militants fired more than 250 missiles at Israel, killing two women, the first Israeli casualties in the current violence. At least 28 Palestinians, including 9 children, have been reported killed in Gaza. And earlier, I spoke with reporter Linda Gradstein, who's been following the situation closely.
What we've had in the last few hours are barrages of more than 100 rockets fired at central Israel. Everybody from Tel Aviv, Herzliya, the central coasts and bomb shelters. You've had extensive Israeli attacks on Gaza. We don't have casualty figures from that yet, but Gaza is one of the most densely populated areas in the world. In yesterday's attacks on Gaza, the Palestinians say that at least 20 people were killed, including 3 children. Israel says that only a few fighters were killed. And it's very hard to kind of prove these. Most recently, there was a rocket that hit a bus in central Israel. The bus was empty, but 3 Israelis, including a 5-year-old, were wounded. And it's an example of one of these things where once these things start, they kind of take on a life of their own. And if the casualty figures mount on both sides, that's going to provide an impetus for both sides to keep the fighting going.
Linda, Israel is known for its missile defense shield that they term the Iron Dome. And going back in my memory, I can't recall, at least in recent times when militants have launched rockets at Israel, that there's been penetration of that missile defense shield and resulted in casualties. Can you kind of put things in perspective and give us, you know, kind of the history of that?
Right. So the Iron Dome system can knock down the missiles, but at some point, a few are going to get through. The firing at Jerusalem for Israel is kind of a red line. And firing, there were in 2014, there were a couple of rockets fired at the outskirts of Jerusalem. But it becomes kind of a show of power that Hamas is saying to Israel, look, we can hit every place in Israel. Israel is concerned that Hezbollah might get involved. Now, while most of the rockets from Hamas are short and medium rockets and can be hit by the Iron Dome, the rockets from Hezbollah are much larger and potentially could cause much more damage. So Israel, of course, is watching that closely. And Iron Dome has been quite successful in knocking down most of the rockets, but you're always going to have a situation where one or two slip through. And then the question becomes, how do you move from here? Do the parties want to move towards de-escalation or not?
Now, speaking of de-escalation, you know, have there been any overtures by any parties in the region to kind of step in and, you know, try to mitigate the circumstances?
Well, Egypt has offered to mediate. In the past, Egypt has close ties with Hamas, and Egypt has offered to mediate between Israel and Hamas. So far, Israel has not responded. On the other hand, the festival that ends Ramadan, and some people are saying that it might be an opportunity to kind of calm things down. It's a holiday where people spend time with their families, and that it might be a good opportunity to calm things down. It's also the first Israeli-Palestinian crisis that the Biden administration is facing. And the Biden administration has, of course, condemned both the rocket attacks and the Israeli Israeli response. And the question is, again, whether they will also try to get involved.
Reporter Linda Gradstein. United Nations spokesperson Stéphane Dujarric says the international organization is working to de-escalate the situation.
The Secretary General is gravely concerned by the serious escalations in the occupied Palestinian territory and Israel, including the latest escalations in Gaza, which add to the heightened tensions and violence in occupied East Jerusalem. He is deeply saddened to learn of the increasingly large numbers of casualties, including children, from Israeli airstrikes in Gaza, and of Israeli fatalities from rockets launched from Gaza. The Secretary General's thoughts are with the families of the victims. Israeli security forces must exercise maximum restraint and calibrate their use of force. The indiscriminate launching of rockets and mortars towards Israeli population centers is unacceptable. This spiraling escalation must cease immediately. The United Nations is working with all relevant parties to de-escalate the situation urgently.
Israel has set some 80 jets to bomb Gaza on Tuesday and massed tanks on the border as rocket barrages continue to hit Israeli towns for a second day. This is the most serious outbreak of fighting since 2019 between Israel and armed factions in Gaza. It was triggered by clashes between Palestinians and Israeli police at Jerusalem's Al-Aqsa Mosque on Monday. Turkey's foreign minister is visiting Saudi Arabia in a bid to repair deeply strained relations. This visit is part of broader regional efforts by Ankara to stem its growing isolation in the region. Dorian Jones is up next.
Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu's two-day visit to Saudi Arabia that started Monday follows this month's phone call between President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and Saudi King Salman. The visit comes as the escalating rivalry between the two countries plunges relations to an historic low, with Turkey at one point accusing Saudi Arabia of enforcing a trade embargo. Turkish presidential adviser Mesut Çavuşoğlu says Ankara is now looking for a reset.
Ankara is looking closer ties with Saudi Arabia, beneficial for the regional peace and security. And Saudi Arabia, you know that, very important for Turkey. But there are positive atmosphere and an intention to repair. First, improve the economic relations in trade side. Saudi Arabia, the ban in some of the Turkish products, it's not very good for Turkey. We have to repair this situation.
Riyadh denies enforcing an embargo, but Ankara claims exports to the kingdom had fallen by 90% in the last year. Observers say Erdogan and Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman have been competing for regional leadership in the Middle East. Following the 2018 murder of Saudi dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Erdogan led international calls to hold Riyadh to account. Hüseyin Barca, head of the Ankara-based Foreign Policy Institute, said Erdogan has ceased those efforts.
Tayyip Erdogan has realized that this policy cannot continue. They see that the cooperation is more important, not confrontation, but cooperation. Tayyip Erdogan's personal sympathy for Saudi Arabia as an Islamist was always there. For him not to have good relations with Saudi Arabia is not acceptable.
Ankara also sees Riyadh as playing an essential role in its bid to repair relations with Egypt. Last week, high-level Turkish and Egyptian talks in Cairo to restore full diplomatic ties appear to have made little progress. Turkish media reports citing Egyptian officials speaking anonymously say Cairo is pressing for a withdrawal of Turkish forces from Libya and the extradition of Egyptian regime opponents living in Turkey. Soli Özel, who teaches international relations at Istanbul's Kadir Has University, says Turkey is in an increasingly vulnerable position.
I think it's serious because the country is very isolated, and quite frankly, Turkey needs to have decent relations with all those countries, certainly with Egypt and Saudi Arabia. Otherwise, it would be isolated both in the Middle East and Eastern Mediterranean.
With the Turkish economy struggling and its isolation growing, Ankara sees no choice but to reach out and start making friends again. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
Pakistan on Tuesday ruled out the possibility of again providing its military bases to the United States for future counterterrorism operations in Afghanistan after U.S. troops leave the conflict-torn neighbor by September 11th. U.S. President Joe Biden's administration has acknowledged it is in talks with several Central Asian neighbors of Afghanistan to hold troops. They are examining where the U.S. can reposition troops to prevent the landlocked country from once again becoming a terrorist base for groups like Al-Qaeda. But U.S. officials have not named Pakistan, which shares a nearly 2,600-kilometer border with Afghanistan, nor have they commented on media speculation that the subject of bases might be under bilateral discussions. You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Steve Miller. Crowds of mostly young men set fire to the perimeter of the Iranian consulate in Iraq following the latest killing of a protester and wounding of a journalist. Many protesters blame pro-Iranian militias for the killings. The Iraqi prime minister is also vowing to find and arrest the perpetrators. Edward Duranian has that story.
The assassination of a protester in the Iraqi Shiite shrine town of Karbala Sunday night, along with the attempted assassination of a journalist in Diwaniya, led protesters to set fires outside the Iranian consulate, prompting an outcry from Tehran. Protesters set fire to the same consulate in November 2019. Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kazemi, himself a former journalist, vowed to uncover and prosecute those who were behind the latest attacks, as well as previous killings of protesters. He told journalists that an investigative committee has been set up, including a group of retired judges with experience, to investigate and question witnesses to determine what happened and eventually reach a conclusion. Top Shiite leaders Ammar Hakim and Muqtada Sadr both protested the shootings. Hakim said efforts to assassinate protesters and journalists to stop their voices from being heard seem aimed at making the situation worse in the country. Sadr called the killing a cowardly tactic and urged Iraqis to stay calm. Iraqi analyst Salam Mashkour tells VOA that the current violence is part of a political conflict between Iran on one side and the U.S. and Saudi Arabia on the other, and that Iraq is caught in the middle. The country is gearing up for parliamentary elections on June 6th, and Mashkour argues that some groups are trying to force the government to postpone them.
There was a goal to delay the election. Somebody want to postpone the election. That's why they create violence in the streets. To create security, difficult security situation, which is to prevent the election.
Khatar Abu Diab, who teaches political science at the University of Paris, notes that many young Iraqis, both Sunni and Shiite, would like to see an independent state, and that objective has brought mostly young protesters into the streets. He says that the pro-Iranian militias, which are part of the popular mobilization forces known as Al-Hashd al-Shaabi in Arabic, have a logic of violence. And since they have been unable to put down the street protests, they have tried to knock off various leaders of the movement. Popular protests against the Iraqi government began in the summer of 2019 in the port city of Basra amid shortages of clean water, fuel, and electricity. They later spread to Baghdad and other cities in October 2019. Former Prime Minister Adel Abdel Mahdi resigned in May 2020, giving way to Kazemi, who is not aligned with the U.S. or Iran. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
In India, volunteers of a nonprofit organization have been quietly collecting the ashes of unclaimed dead of COVID-19 from crematoriums in and around New Delhi. They're giving the bodies a respectful send-off, according to Hindu traditions, amid an unprecedented surge in deaths from the pandemic. Reuters' Olivia Chan brings us the story.
At New Delhi's main crematorium, two volunteers from NGO Sri Deodhan Sewa Samiti have been quietly collecting the ashes of India's unclaimed dead, giving the bodies a send-off as per Hindu traditions. Ashish Kashyap respectfully washes the remains and prays over them.
These are the unclaimed remains of COVID-19 victims. During this pandemic, the relatives of these victims abandoned them. However, our organization collects these remains from all the crematoriums and performs the last rituals in Haridwar so that they can achieve salvation. 95% of the remains belong to COVID-19 victims. 95% corona se ekatrit
wo hain astiyan. The ashes are taken to the river Ganges, a river many Hindus consider holy, for a final ritual, which is said to ensure the souls of the deceased go to heaven and escape the cycle of rebirth. The following graphic video was obtained from Ghazipur district, where about 100 bodies of suspected COVID-19 patients were floating in the Ganges. Several villages along the riverbanks were alerted by the smell and informed the local authorities. India's coronavirus crisis shows scant sign of easing on Tuesday. The country's seven-day average of new cases is at a record high, with over 390,000 reported cases. International health authorities are warning the country's variant of the virus poses a global concern. India also leads in the daily average number of new deaths reported. According to a Reuters tally, the country accounts for one of every three deaths reported worldwide each day. For the volunteers at New Delhi's main crematorium, the abandoned deceased deserve a respectful farewell despite the overwhelming numbers.
Olivia Chan reports for Reuters News. The United Nations warns that Somalia faces a perilous future as drought followed by torrential rains have destroyed this year's planting season. Lisa Schlein takes it from here.
Somalia is one of the countries in the world most prone to the erratic and calamitous impacts of climate change. It has been hit by a double climate disaster for more than 2 weeks that is likely to worsen its already acute situation of food insecurity. The drought, which was declared on April 25th, was soon followed by torrential rains that caused flash floods and rivers to overflow. The UN Organization for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs reports the rains came too late for the planting season. OCHA spokesman Jens Laerke says floods have killed at least 25 people in various parts of the country. The victims include 9 children who died when their house flooded in the Benadir region in the capital, Mogadishu.
The Juba River has burst its banks, houses have been washed away, and livestock have perished. There are also reports of flooding in the north of the country, and there are continuous flash flood warnings across Somalia, especially for people living in low-lying areas. In flooded areas, local communities are struggling to prevent further flooding by placing sandbags, poles, and other materials to reinforce riverbanks.
The World Food Program reports 2.7 million Somalis are short of food, with more than 500,000 on the brink of famine. An estimated 300,000 children under age 5 are malnourished, including 48,000 who are severely malnourished and at high risk of disease and death. Archer spokesman Laerke warns the combined impact of drought and floods is likely to worsen this critical situation.
Both climate shocks cause displacement, jeopardize access to safe water, increase waterborne diseases, and impact people's livelihoods. Despite increasing humanitarian needs, the funding forecast for 2021 is the worst in 6 years. This year's Somalia humanitarian response plan requires $1 billion to assist 4 million people. As of today, the plan is only 19% funded.
Laerke says OCHA and partners are using the limited funds at their disposal to step up operations in drought-affected areas and reach at least 353,000 people with aid. Urgent efforts, he adds, also are underway to respond to the flash flooding. The World Food Program reports It has distributed food to more than 20,000 people in Jowar City, one of the areas hardest hit by flooding in central Somalia. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is Science in a Minute.
Findings in a 7-year study provides proof that our ancient human ancestors, including Neanderthals, started adding foods that are rich in carbohydrates to their diets some 100,000 years ago, much earlier than thought. They started eating high-carb roots, seeds, and starchy vegetables. Carbohydrates convert to glucose in the human body, and glucose is the main source of fuel for the brain. The study suggests while our ancient ancestors may not have known of the importance of this dietary change, adding these foods may have fueled the expansion of the brain as these species evolved. To reach their findings, the study researchers recreated and analyzed the oral microbiomes from the fossilized dental plaque of Neanderthals, primates, and humans. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The recent guilty verdict in the trial of the officer who killed George Floyd came after months of street demonstrations and calls for greater police accountability. Police reform faces an uphill climb in the U.S. Congress, and as VOA's Arash Arabasadi reports, some worry it won't go nearly far enough.
Before the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin began, the House of Representatives passed the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act. It is now up to the Senate to act.
We should not mistake a guilty verdict in this case as evidence that the persistence problem of police misconduct has been solved, or that the divide between law enforcement and so many of the communities they serve has been bridged. It has not.
Schumer and other Democratic lawmakers call for policy changes in policing, such as repealing qualified immunity and creating a database of police officers and the complaints against them. Not going quite as far, Republican Senator Rick Scott, a vocal supporter of law enforcement, called for greater accountability on ABC's This Week.
I think you start with more transparency, and I think you bring in, you do what I've done, what I did as governor. You sit down with law enforcement and say, okay, so what can we do to be better, and why are some officers better, some departments better than others, rather than saying, oh, everybody is doing the wrong thing, and create an incentive for people not to do their job.
Greg Carr is chair of Afro-American Studies at Howard University in Washington. He calls for a total overhaul of policing in the United States.
We see, for example, what happened during the Floyd trial as another Minneapolis area person was killed by a police officer. That officer resigned from the force. Now, the question becomes, if they want to, do they show up in an adjacent police district with a new job? And so part of this national database will at least take away from local police departments the excuse, oh, we didn't know or we didn't check. No. And so I think it's incremental, this need to remake policing. We're not talking about reform. We're talking about remaking policing.
Police unions have resisted a national database and other reform efforts in support of their members. Detroit Police Chief James Craig says law enforcement needs community backing and that morale is already low.
When you talk about defunding and you're not speaking up on behalf of the good men and women who are out doing the job the correct way, and nobody in a seat of influence is standing up in a courageous way and denouncing the rhetoric, then they don't feel supported. And so people are leaving. So good luck at trying to rehire or hiring a new group of officers to fill the void.
For now, however, the reform legislation is stalled in the evenly split Senate because of Republican opposition, and Chauvin, who is being held in a maximum security prison near Minneapolis, will be sentenced in June. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
A community of Asian Americans and their allies in Los Angeles are offering free self-defense classes. Volunteer trainers hope to equip people with the skills that could save them from the rising violence against Asians in the United States. Noparat Chajila Moncorn narrates this story.
Someone's right here. Grabbing them.
Akemi Luk is one of the students interested in free self-defense classes taught by professional instructors who volunteer at the Pan Pacific Park in Los Angeles.
You try to pull them down with those hands, because I already feel her pulling me a little hard.
She hopes the techniques will be helpful when it's necessary, as many Asians have been targets of violence.
So if we get attacked, we have to know how to fight back. We have to know the techniques, and we have to know how to protect ourselves.
Geisha Colton is a single mother who has survived a sexual assault. Like Luke, Colton hopes that learning self-defense is a preemptive step.
I don't want to have to ever be in that position where I have to learn how to protect my own life if I'm being attacked. But obviously, because of the world we live in, it's unfortunately a reality for all people, especially now for Asian, especially for women. Women are always, you know, we're always going to be vulnerable for attacks.
Even with my arms, I can still do this. I can grab and squeeze.
Sabrina Johnson and Alexandra Bernal volunteered to teach the self-defense class. Although they're not of Asian descent, they feel that it's important to use their expertise in helping other people combat violence against Asians.
And I think as an ally, if you're not Asian yourself, but you see someone being attacked that's Asian or of any race, if you know self-defense, you could intervene. You could have the confidence to tell that person harassing them, like, hey, stop bothering that person.
Trainers say they will continue to offer classes like this for the Asian American community, hoping they will empower people to combat a rise in discriminatory attacks. For Supakit Patratiranun in Los Angeles, Noprat Chaichala Mongkon, VOA News.
After more than a year in shutdown brought on by the COVID-19 pandemic, 8 Smithsonian Museum facilities in and around Washington are reopening this month. VOA's Julie Tabo rounds us out.
The Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum's Udvar-Hazy Center in Chantilly, Virginia, has reopened its doors for the first time since closing for the coronavirus pandemic last year. It's the first of 8 Smithsonian museums that are reopening this month, with pandemic-related safety measures in place, such as limited time entries, the use of face coverings, and social distancing. The Udvar-Hazy Center is larger than its companion facility, the National Air and Space Museum on the National Mall in Washington.
It has the large artifacts, the big aircraft that couldn't fit downtown, and so it presents them more in a hangar-style format where people can just look at the artifacts, soak them in, and kind of bring their experiences.
On display for the first time are 2 historic objects that commemorate the reopening of the museum, as well as the 60th anniversary of the first American space flight. An F-18 Hornet jet fighter that was flown by the famous Blue Angels Navy Squadron, and the capsule that carried the first American into space, which helped launch the American space program.
The addition of new artifacts on display or acquisitions like the Blue Angels Hornet or the Freedom 7 capsule, that allows us to tell these big stories.
Also on display are the Lockheed SR-71 Blackbird, the fastest jet aircraft in the world. The space shuttle Discovery, the longest-serving, oldest-surviving space shuttle, and the Enola Gay, the B-29 that dropped the atomic bomb over Hiroshima, Japan during World War II. Visitors of all ages enjoyed both the old and the new.
Our granddaughter loves it here. I open space, all the airplanes roaming around. She gets to see a lot of history. She's only 3.5 years old, and she is already informing us of what some of these planes did in the past and so forth. So it's pretty amazing.
We just wanted to get out, since we've kind of been cooped up during COVID, to let the boys experience being outside, being in the museum, and seeing some of the wonderful airplanes.
We love looking at airplanes. A couple times we've seen the Blue Angels fly in the sky, and it's cool to see the history of all the different planes as they evolved throughout the years, and maybe pique their interest in becoming a pilot in the future if they wanted to become one, or even an astronaut.
6 more Smithsonian museums and the National Zoo are scheduled to reopen later this month. They include the National Museum of African American History and Culture, the National Portrait Gallery, the Smithsonian American Art Museum and its Renwick Gallery, the National Museum of American History, and the National Museum of the American Indian.
I've always felt that you can tell so much about a nation by what it remembers, and even more by what it forgets. So I want to make sure the Smithsonian helps America remember not just what it wants, but what it needs to remember.
Julie Tabo, VOA News, Washington.
And that'll do it for us today. This has been VOA's International Edition. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Alexandria, Virginia. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.